Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from a double issue. It's the September 17th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. And for the first time I can remember, the cover is a photograph rather than a colored drawing. The scene is an airport tarmac. I'm pretty sure it's in Kabul. And in the foreground are a lot of American soldiers in full battle gear. A smaller group of them is carrying a coffin draped with an American flag. Very somber scene. In the background, you see a lot more both Army folks and civilians looking on, and two of the big transport planes. It's a clear blue sky and a very bright, bright picture over a somber scene. The headline is "Why the U.S. Lost: The End of Our 20 Years in Afghanistan." And we've got several stories on that. We'll split the material in this magazine over the next two shows, so we'll see where we get. Start this week with the editor's letter. Farewell to nation building. Historians, analysts, and pundits will spend years sorting out the lessons of the U.S.'s failed 20-year war in Afghanistan. But this much is clear. We can't expect that any amount of money, troops, bombs, or deaths can turn a hostile, broken nation with a determined insurgency into a friendly, functional democracy. The U.S. had searing proof of that in Vietnam, but the shock of 9/11 created a national amnesia that the Bush administration exploited in trying to nation-build Afghanistan and then, more recklessly, Iraq. Enormous sacrifices by our soldiers and the people of these nations have yielded chaos, carnage, disappointment, new terrorist groups, and a flood of refugees. We assume that because we are very powerful, we can achieve things that are unachievable. Emma Ashford of the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security told the New York Times this week, "We overreach. In overreaching, we've learned we can vaporize a terrorist through a drone operated hundreds of miles away, only to see more spring up in his place. We can move dictators like Saddam Hussein and Muammar al-Qaddafi, but in the ensuing vacuum, we can't erase ancient sectarian and tribal divisions and create peaceful, self-governing nations. We can restrain the aggressions of Russia, China, and North Korea, but only to a limited degree. This isn't to say the U.S. is powerless or that isolationism is a viable alternative. Our military remains a necessary check on bully states and autocrats, our economy a powerful engine of progress, our freedom and ideals, however perfectly realized, an inspiration. Warts and all, the U.S. is still an indispensable nation. But as we recover from our bad habit of trying to fix what can't be fixed, our leaders might find some needed guidance in the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." That was William Falk, editor-in-chief of The Week magazine. And we'll go into the first main story. U.S. ends the nation's longest war. What happened? The last U.S. forces left Afghanistan this week, bringing an end to the longest war in the nation's history after 20 years. Some $2 trillion spent and nearly 2,500 American lives lost. The final C-17 cargo jets left Kabul's airport at 1 minute before midnight in Kabul as the August 31 deadline set by President Biden arrived. The military mission is over, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken. A new chapter of America's engagement with Afghanistan has begun. The departure followed two chaotic weeks in which about 123,000 people, including some 6,000 Americans, were airlifted out. 13 U.S. service members and about 170 Afghans were killed in an airport suicide attack by the terrorist group ISIS-K. America's exit returned control of the country to the Taliban, whom the U.S. had driven from power after invading in 2001. It also left behind tens of thousands of Afghans who'd worked with Americans and were desperate to flee, as well as an indeterminate number of Americans that Blinken estimated at under 200. Our commitment to them has no deadline, Blinken said. Under fire for the chaotic withdrawal, President Biden called the evacuation an extraordinary success and said a messy exit was inevitable. He emphatically defended his decision to leave Afghanistan, saying that after his predecessor, former President Trump, agreed to withdraw all U.S. troops, his only alternative was to renege and defend against a resulting Taliban offensive by sending in thousands of additional troops. I was not going to extend this forever war, he said. In Kabul, Taliban fighters and their supports unleashed celebratory gunfire as news spread of the Americans' final exit, and fireworks lit up the night sky. It's over, said Taliban fighter Himad Sherzad. Our 20 years of sacrifice worked. But millions of Afghan citizens faced a return to Taliban rule with fear and dread. It's a horrifying moment for the people of Kabul, said a 23-year-old development worker. All I see is dark future for us. What the editorial said. Our hasty, humiliating exit is Biden's disgrace, said the National Review, leaving behind Americans and Afghan allies likely to meet gruesome ends at the hands of the Taliban is a historic low for the U.S., and it didn't have to happen. With a minimal troop and air power presence, Biden could have kept the Taliban at bay. At a minimum, he could have executed a competent pullout. Instead, he turned an unsatisfactory stalemate into a complete rout. Biden is hardly the only president to blame for this mess, said the Chicago Tribune. Trump's foolish deal with the Taliban boxed Biden in, and the current president's determination not to waste more American lives on an endless war is entirely defensible. But the U.S. went into Afghanistan 20 years ago this month because it had become a terrorist launch pad. Terrorists love to fill a power vacuum, and we may be hearing from ISIS-K and other terrorist groups again. What the columnist said. Biden deserves credit, not blame, said David Rothkopf in TheAtlantic.com. His three predecessors saw the futility of the Afghan operation, but lacked the guts to tell Americans the truth and extract us. Biden alone had the political courage to say enough. Facing daunting obstacles, he oversaw a massive withdrawal by air that was one of the most extraordinary logistical feats in history. For a change, an American president has set aside politics and put both America's interests and values first. Biden's unforgivable blundering started with his decision to leave, said Quinn Hillier in WashingtonExaminer.com. Americans wailed so much about our two-decade occupation that they failed to consider that the strategic advantages outweighed the costs. With a troop deployment under 10,000 and minimal casualties, we increased Afghans' life expectancy, liberated the women, and denied our terrorist enemies a stable base of operations. That's a bargain, and both Trump and Biden were foolish to throw it away. The argument that we could have maintained an indefinite occupation is ludicrous, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. The government we were propping up was so corrupt and incompetent that many Afghans preferred the Taliban. Attempts to make Biden the singular scapegoat for our defeat are coming from the very generals and grand strategists who presided over quagmire, folly, and defeat for two decades. As the last U.S. planes left the runway, it seemed a wretched end, said Robin Wright in NewYorker.com. America's bold promises had turned into mission abandonment, and Afghans' liberation had evaporated into the tyranny of extremist rule. At the end of our forever war, a U.S. official in Kabul told me, our exhausted military and diplomatic personnel just wanted out, even as they questioned the frantic chaos of how it was done. Nobody wanted to leave like this. The problem, he said, was that no one knew what better looked like. The second main story is titled, Hurricane Ida Batters the Gulf Coast. What happened? After being lashed by Hurricane Ida's 150-mile-per-hour winds and torrential rains, hundreds of thousands of Gulf Coast residents were left without power and fresh water this week as a 100-degree heat wave settled over the region. Ida smashed into Louisiana as a Category 4 hurricane, ripping off roofs, knocking out transmission lines, flooding roads, and reducing some brick buildings in downtown New Orleans to rubble. At least 8 people died in the storm, and the toll is expected to rise as emergency workers scour wrecked homes and businesses. One of the most powerful hurricanes to ever hit the U.S. mainland, Ida brought a 5 to 12-foot storm surge that inundated low-lying communities in the south in southeastern Louisiana. Grand Isle is now uninhabitable, said Parish President Cynthia Lee Shing. With 3 feet of sand covering the entire barrier island and 40% of the buildings completely destroyed. The storm caused a citywide blackout in New Orleans, but a Hurricane Katrina-level disaster was avoided there, thanks in part to the $14.5 billion spent on new levees, seawalls, and pumps after the 2005 storm. Experts are warning that Ida could worsen the COVID crisis in the Gulf Coast as residents crowd together in homes and emergency shelters without immediate access to testing or medical care. ICUs in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama hospitals were already near capacity before the storm hit. Nearly 1 million people are still without power across Louisiana, and authorities warned it could be weeks before electricity is restored. If you have already evacuated, said Governor John Bel Edwards, do not return here. What the editorial said. Hurricane Katrina killed some 2,000 people because the old levees around New Orleans failed catastrophically and the city flooded, said the Baton Rouge advocate. This year, the new levees worked, and the flooding that did occur was either from local rainfall within the levees or outside the federally built system. The lesson? Hardening infrastructure against unpredictable Mother Nature pays off, said the Wall Street Journal. Here's hoping the feds will now focus on making coastal cities more resilient rather than on pumping cash into green energy boondoggles. Ida is just the latest preview of the horror show that climate change is set to inflict on the planet, said USA Today. The warning signs are all around us this summer. Wildfires raging in California, a water shortage on the Colorado River, a drought in a dozen states from the Midwest to the Northwest, and things will get worse for the Gulf Coast if we don't decarbonize our economy. Every degree Celsius of warming allows the air to hold about 7% more water, meaning storms will bring bigger deluges, and warming waters allow tropical storms to suddenly increase in strength. That might explain why Ida intensified into a Category 4 just hours before landing. What the columnist said. Hurricane Ida may have been the first storm of the new normal, said Melody Schreiber in NewRepublic.com. in which overlapping crises make natural disasters much, much harder to fight. The massive spike in COVID-19 cases in Louisiana has made it more difficult to evacuate hospitals. And even healthy evacuees face a higher risk of getting or passing on the virus when they're forced to travel or bunk down with others in often cramped conditions. As a lifelong Louisianan, I've lived through a lot of storm-tossed nights, and they are never easy, said Danny Heitman in the Wall Street Journal. You never know whether that moment when electric transformers surrender to the gusts portends only minor cleanup or the kind of mass death and despair we saw after Katrina. I'm grateful that my house survived this onslaught, but I know that Louisiana's long night of suffering isn't really over. America's focus on my native city's plight will quickly fade, said Andy Horowitz in the New York Times. Everybody declares their love for the Big Easy when it's in the headlines or when they're here enjoying a long weekend. But few people love New Orleans enough to insist, once they get back home, that their congressional representatives vote for the climate and infrastructure projects that might give the city a few extra decades. If you do live near a coast, I can't counsel solidarity today. Our climate change woes aren't unique, and you may be next. And here's a short piece from the It Wasn't All Bad. Much needed, I'd say, at this point. In 1994, Army Private Martin Adler was searching houses in the Italian village of Cassano di Monte Rosino when he heard a sound coming from a wicker container. He prepared to open fire, thinking a Nazi soldier was hiding inside, when a woman burst into the room screaming, "Bambini!" Two girls and a boy then emerged from the basket. Shocked and relieved, Adler asked if he could have his photo taken with the kids. Last year, in a bid to cheer up her dad amid the pandemic, Adler's daughter launched an online campaign to track down the children in the picture. Adler, 97, and the three Bambini, Bruno Naldi, 83, Mafalda, 82, and Giuliana, 80, reunited in Bologna last week. "My heart is bursting," Adler said. "Grazie. Grazie." Our controversy of the week is the pandemic, why gloom is setting in. September has arrived, and with it a jarring sense of deja vu for most Americans, said Ed Yong in TheAtlantic.com. A pandemic that looked to be winding down in the spring is surging again thanks to the highly infectious Delta variant and the ongoing reluctance of so many Americans to get vaccinated. As of this week, more than 100,000 Americans are hospitalized with COVID-19, the highest total since January. Deaths have more than doubled in 2 weeks to an average of more than 1,300 per day. And in poorly vaccinated southern states, ICUs are at capacity and hospitals are bringing in mobile morgues to store the dead. Pediatric COVID cases are also now skyrocketing, with 200,000 new infections in a week and 330 kids admitted to hospitals every day. Troubling new data show that the vaccines start losing effectiveness after 6 months, which partly explains the current wave of breakthrough infections among the vaccinated. "Gloom is setting in," said Caitlin Owens in Axios.com, as vaccinated Americans face the disheartening reality that we'll be living with COVID into the spring and for the foreseeable future. "We need a radical shift in our thinking," said Segal Samuel in Vox.com. "Many of us are still stuck in the zero-tolerance mindset of the early pandemic, when it seemed sensible to suspend normal life and hang tight until the vaccines arrived. With the pandemic still raging, it's time for the vaccinated to accept some risk as the cost of resuming a semblance of normal life. At some point, nearly everyone will get a Delta infection, said Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal. For the vaccinated, that may not be the worst thing. You are still 99% protected against dying, and Delta will give you your immunity a de facto booster shot that's likely as robust as any the government will be handing out. That's reckless advice, said Sanjay Gupta in CNN.com. Yes, we vaccinated people can resume a lot of our usual activities. But if we want to protect unvaccinated children and avoid the horror of another winter surge, we should still try to reduce viral transmission by all means necessary. That means stepping up vaccination outreach and wearing masks in crowded indoor spaces, including schools. The pandemic will end when COVID becomes endemic, said Sarah Zhang in TheAtlantic.com. At that point, enough people have gained some immunity through vaccination or infection that the virus produces milder illness. Letting the virus rip might be our quickest way of reaching that point, but it would also kill the most people along the way. The crux of the problem, said Joseph Allen in the New York Times, is that we don't know what we're actually trying to achieve. If minimizing death and suffering is our objective, we should commit to a strategy of mask and vaccine mandates. If endemic COVID is the goal, then a less restrictive strategy makes sense. We also still lack the data needed to make good policies, said Zeynep Tufekci, also in the Times. Can vaccinated people spread the virus? Does the Delta variant make children sicker than its predecessors? Or are more children getting sick because Delta is more infectious? We just don't know. Heading into this grim fall, it's not just the pandemic's persistence that's making people feel so blue. It's the realization that 2 years into this nightmare, we're still stumbling in the fog. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for seniors, with a new study of 702 people aged 58 and older showing that some critical mental faculties become sharper with age. As people get older, the study concluded their brains are better able to attend to new information and to focus on what's important. It was a good week for consequences after NFL teams released a number of unvaccinated players, including New England Patriots veteran quarterback Cam Newton. Under league rules, teams with outbreaks among unvaccinated players can forfeit games, lose pay, and be fined. It was a good week for gangsters after Al Capone's granddaughters put the crime boss's personal items up for auction, including his favorite semi-automatic Colt pistol, a slew of diamond-encrusted money clips, tie pins and watches, and a photo of him smiling lovingly at his mother. But it was a bad week for misspelled forgeries after an Illinois woman, Chloe Morsock, 24, was arrested in Hawaii and charged with submitting a fake vaccination card that she said she'd received the Moderna shot, M-A-D-E-R-N-A. It's a bad week for traditionalists with Harvard University's announcement that its new chief chaplain is an atheist. Greg Epstein, 44, is a humanist chaplain at the university and a favorite among students who describe themselves as spiritual, but not religious. Finally, it was a bad week for resignation. After Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves explained his COVID-ravaged state's last in the nation 37% vaccination rate and its residents' disdain for masking as a function of their strong Christianity. When you believe in eternal life, said Reeves, then you don't have to be so scared of things. we're going to read some of the short pieces from the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance this week, starting with the U.S. at a glance. San Diego, RFK killer. The children of Robert F. Kennedy were deeply divided over a parole board panel's vote last week in favor of the releasing Sirhan Sirhan from prison, more than 50 years after he was convicted of fatally shooting the Democratic presidential candidate at Los Angeles Ambassador Hotel. Sirhan, 77, determined to be mentally ill at the time of the 1968 assassination, told the parole board that he was an impulsive kid when he committed such a horrible deed. Two of RFK's nine surviving children, Douglas and Robert Jr., spoke in favor of Sirhan's release, with Douglas saying he was deeply moved by Sirhan's remorse. Robert believes a conspiracy theory that Sirhan wasn't the real shooter. The full parole board will review Sirhan's case for 4 months before sending a recommendation to the governor. RFK's children, Courtney, Carrie, Chris, Maxwell, Maury, and the former representative Joseph P. Kennedy, said they were devastated by the parole recommendation, promising to fight it every step of the way. Texas abortion ban. The nation's most restrictive abortion law took effect this week in Texas after the Supreme Court declined to act on an emergency request from clinics to block it. The GOP-backed law bans abortion if a fetal heartbeat is detected after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, which abortion rights advocates say eliminates the guarantee of Roe v. Wade that women had the right to terminate a pregnancy until a fetus can survive outside the womb at about 24 weeks. About 85% of Texan women who obtain abortions are at least 6 weeks pregnant. Federal judges have blocked GOP-led heartbeat bills in other states, but in a maneuver to evade Roe, Texas officials won't enforce the six-week limit, instead authorizing any private citizen to sue people suspected of aiding or abetting abortions, including doctors or Uber drivers who take women to clinics for $10,000. Until such lawsuits are filed and challenged, the Supreme Court may not intervene. Florida and Alabama. Morgues overwhelmed. 14 portable morgues were sent this week to overburdened hospitals in Central Florida after the state reported more than 1,700 COVID-19 deaths last week, its highest number ever. The portable morgues, each capable of holding 12 bodies, were rented after local funeral homes couldn't keep up. Deaths are also surging in Alabama, where officials activated two refrigerated morgue trailers last week for the first time during the pandemic. Several hospitals in Florida, as well as South Carolina, Texas, and Louisiana, were struggling with shortages of oxygen needed to keep COVID patients alive. A Florida judge this week sided with parents from six counties who sued Governor Ron DeSantis for banning mask mandates in schools, saying he'd overstepped his authority. In defiance, DeSantis said he would withhold paychecks to school board members in two counties to protect parents' rights. More than 20,000 Florida kids under 12 tested positive for COVID last week. And the world at a glance, Algeria. Get the lead out. Algeria, the last country in the world to use leaded gas in cars, has finally phased out the toxic fuel. The country had held massive reserves of leaded gas, but reported them empty at the end of July. In the early 20th century, lead was added to improve engine function, but scientists discovered that exposure to emissions contaminated with the heavy metal can cause heart disease and strokes and harm brain development, especially among children. The U.S. began phasing out lead gas in the 1970s, but many developing countries kept using the poisonous additive. The United Nations Environment Program launched a campaign to phase out leaded fuel everywhere in 2002. The successful enforcement of the ban on leaded petrol is a huge milestone for global health and our environment, said UNEP head Inger Andersen. Goya, Argentina. dying river. South America's second longest river is drying up. The waters of the 3,032-mile-long Paraná, which flows from Brazil through Paraguay and Argentina, are at their lowest level since 1944. The river's average flow rate has dropped to 1.6 million gallons a second from 4.5 million gallons, a decrease that is affecting commercial shipping, fishing, and the provision of drinking water. The amount of energy generated by the Yacyretá hydroelectric plant, which supplies 14% of Argentina's power, has fallen by half. Last year we thought we'd hit rock bottom, but this year it got worse, said plant manager Marcelo Cardinale. Southern Brazil, where the river starts, has seen 3 years of below-average rainfall, and environmentalists say global warming and deforestation are exacerbating the drought. Brussels. Americans off safe travel list. Because of the surge in COVID cases across America, the European Union has removed the U.S. from the safe travel list of countries whose residents can enter the bloc without restrictions. Fully vaccinated Americans will likely still be able to travel freely in the EU's 27 member nations, but the unvaccinated could face quarantines, testing requirements, or bans, depending on the country they're visiting. The EU's ruling is not binding, and different countries can institute different requirements. Countries with tourism-dependent economies, including Greece, Italy, Croatia, and Spain, are likely to continue admitting unvaccinated Americans who test negative for COVID. Negotiations for a joint EU-US digital vaccination passport are still ongoing. More than 15 million Americans a year visited Europe before the pandemic. Moscow. Get out or else. The spokeswoman for imprisoned opposition leader Alexei Navalny fled Russia this week, the latest in a stream of dissidents and rights activists who have left the country under threat of harsh punishment by President Vladimir Putin's regime. Kira Yarmish had been under house arrest since February for protesting Navalny's detention and was this month sentenced to 18 more months of restricted movement, a parole-like penalty. She is now in Finland. Navalny's top aide, Lyubov Sobol, departed for Turkey in early August after receiving a similar sentence. Authorities gave both women some time before their sentences went into effect, a signal that they had one last chance to leave Russia. Their strategy is first, squeeze them out, said Dmitry Gudkov, an opposition politician who fled in June. And if you can't squeeze them out, throw them in jail. Johannesburg. New COVID variant. Virologists are keeping an eye on a new strain of COVID-19 that was first detected in South Africa in May and has since spread to at least seven other countries in Africa, Europe, Asia, and Oceania. The variant, known as C.1.2, is the most highly mutated of all the strains sequenced so far. It carries changes that have given other strains increased transmissibility and the ability to overcome some of the immunity provided by vaccines or previous infections. Still, scientists note that a variant isn't automatically more dangerous because it has more mutations. Some changes can weaken a virus, and an extra mutation can cancel out the effects of others. I'm going to read three of our longer columns this week and then circle back and pick up a few more in the next show. We'll start with United Kingdom, the Great Brexit Labor Shortage. Britons are facing empty grocery shelves and shuttered restaurants, said the Times in an editorial. A shortage of labor, particularly of truck drivers, has wrecked the just-in-time supply chains that our economy depends on. The result? McDonald's is out of milkshakes, Well, fast food chain Nando's had to close 50 restaurants last week for lack of chicken. This isn't simply a byproduct of the pandemic. Foreign workers perform many low-wage and arduous jobs in the UK, such as trucking. But their numbers have declined in the post-Brexit era, because many workers can no longer move freely between our country and the European Union. Businesses could largely resolve this problem by offering higher wages to attract British workers, but so far firms have been reluctant to increase their fixed costs when they can't yet be sure whether demand will rebound. This was all predictable and predicted, said The Guardian. Proponents of Brexit claimed that Eastern Europeans were stealing our jobs. The truth was the tasks they did and the conditions under which they worked might not appeal to British workers. Companies will eventually adapt, but there will be pain along the way. Without enough truck drivers on the road, there's no way to transport goods from factories, farms, and ports, said Ben Chapman in independent.co.uk. About a quarter of food, retail, and manufacturing businesses have reported shortages of supplies in recent weeks. COVID saw a boom in home improvement as lockdown Brits tackled kitchen renovations. But DIYers and contractors can't buy the pipes and fixtures they need to complete these projects. Construction firms, which depend on European makers for many products that have no British supplier, say they can't get a hold of windows, doors, cement, timber, drywall, steel, and cladding materials. Most of these problems are down to COVID, said Stephen Glover in the Daily Mail. The whole world is grappling with supply chain disruptions during the pandemic. Still, it's true that thousands of foreign truckers did head home after we formally quit the European Union last year. But isn't this a cause for celebration? Many Britons voted for Brexit in 2016 because they were upset at being undercut by cheap labor from Poland, Bulgaria, and Romania. Now that the Eastern Europeans are gone, companies will have to pay more, and that will in due course attract more homegrown people to lorry driving. Also, many businesses hope to solve the trucker shortage not with higher wages, said Ross Clark in the Daily Telegraph, but with bigger tractor trailers. The government has approved a plan to add 7 feet to the standard 43-foot trailer. Never mind that the existing trucks already struggle to negotiate roads without sideswiping cottages and passing cars. How will we accommodate these juggernauts? Will the government invest in bypasses around the choke points of our largely medieval system of local roads? Nope, that's not planned. So this is the legacy of Brexit. We have taken back control only to have monster lorries let loose on our towns. The faceless technocrats Brexiteers decried are still in charge, just in London rather than in Brussels. This is a How They See Us International column. A retreat that emboldens Islamic radicals. When Joe Biden arrived in the White House, he told America's allies that the U.S. was back, said Israel Harel in Haaretz from Israel. But just 8 months later, the president has shattered that pledge with his ignominious retreat from Afghanistan, a withdrawal that will encourage everyone with evil intentions. In Iran, the mullahs will accelerate the nuclear program, confident that Biden's promise to prevent them from getting a bomb is written on melting ice. In Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere, an exhilarated ISIS will regroup and recruit. This prediction of chaos isn't mere pessimism. It's a truth drawn from Israeli history. After we withdrew our troops unilaterally from Lebanon in 2000, Hezbollah took effective control there. The Iran-backed militia now has tens of thousands of missiles pointed our way. Had we withdrawn gradually while making agreements with other Lebanese factions, perhaps we would have peace with Lebanon today. We made the same mistake in Gaza 5 years later, pulling out abruptly and ceding the territory to Hamas, then a marginal terrorist organization, and now a major Palestinian force. What we learned, painfully, the U.S. will now learn. Anyone who flees from conflict with Islamist terror will be pursued by that same terror. It's already happening, said Zarar Khuro in Dawn from Pakistan. Even as the Americans were trying to evacuate their Afghan translators and aides, a suicide bomber with ISIS-K blew himself up at the Kabul airport, killing more than 180 people, including 13 Americans. The Taliban may be a homegrown Afghan phenomenon, but ISIS is a true child of American foreign policy. The nihilistic death cult was born in Camp Buka, a U.S. prison in Iraq that housed militants captured by the Americans following the 2003 invasion. ISIS's future leaders met there, made their plans there, and indoctrinated recruits there. The dozens who died at the Kabul airport are simply the latest additions to the butcher's bill of America's hubris, hubris-fueled war on terror. The utter debacle of nation-building in Afghanistan is a true blow to American credibility, said Nursin Guni in Anadolu Agency from Turkey. Biden has been trying to rewrite the political history of this failure, pretending that the U.S. entered Afghanistan only to combat terrorism. He insults our intelligence. We have books in our libraries about the U.S.'s nation-building effort. America's failure is apparent, and its excuses pathetic. Iraqis fear they will be next to suffer American abandonment and Islamist takeover, said Sulama Bey. Biden has already announced his intention to pull all combat troops from their country by the end of the year. And just like Afghanistan, Iraq has ISIS sleeper cells ready to spring into action, as well as an armed group ready to take over the government. The Iran-backed popular mobilization forces. As Afghanistan was delivered to the Taliban puppet masters in Pakistan's intelligence service, so Iraq could be handed over entirely to Tehran. Iraqis can only hope that Biden will not withdraw all American personnel, but will instead leave an advisory force as a tripwire. Will Afghanistan be a lesson or a precedent? This is a business column. COVID. Should firms make vaccination mandatory? Corporate America has a new message for unvaccinated workers, said Jonathan Levin in Bloomberg.com. Get the shot or get out. As soon as the Food and Drug Administration granted full approval to Pfizer's COVID vaccine last week, a wave of inoculation mandates swept across the corporate world. Workers at Disney theme parks will be required to show proof of vaccination starting next month to remain employed. Chevron and Hess will demand the same of workers on oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico. And CVS has mandated shots for corporate employees and those working with customers. Delta Airlines has taken a different approach, announcing last week that workers who shun COVID vaccines will have to pay an extra $200 to remain on the company's health plan. At least part of the airline's motivation is financial, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. Delta is self-insured, meaning it pays the medical claims of its own workers, and the average hospital stay for COVID costs the airline $50,000. More companies should jump on board and financially penalize vaccine holdouts. If the threat of a potentially deadly illness won't convince them, well, hopefully the threat to their bank account will. Delta's plan might not yield many new shots, said Niraj Chachki in the New York Times. It's illegal for businesses and insurers to charge higher prices to people with pre-existing health conditions. So the airline's vaccine surcharge is being structured as an employee wellness incentive program. Corporations use such programs, which must be voluntary and can involve rewards or penalties of up to 30% of a worker's health insurance premium, to nudge employees to change their behavior. But studies have found that such incentives have very little impact on employee health. In some cases, they simply nudge workers who are facing penalties to drop their workplace coverage. Delta surcharge is a slippery slope, said David Lazarus in the Los Angeles Times. If we start hiking the health premiums of people who are more likely to get sick, will workers with diabetes, heart disease, or a genetic predisposition for cancer also have to pay more for their coverage? And should drinkers have higher premiums than their teetotaling colleagues? The real problem with these mandates is that they're primarily being imposed on people who don't need them, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. Walmart and Walgreens have mandated vaccines for corporate employees, but not for store and warehouse workers. Uber and Lyft's policies apply to office staff, but not to the drivers who interact with the public. These firms are understandably keen to avoid alienating workers amid a labor shortage, but this two-track approach, with one rule for blue-collar workers and another for white-collar employees who are likely already inoculated, won't speed the end of the pandemic. To do that, we'll need more government to order mandates, as New York City's did with restaurants and gyms. Until then, companies will continue to prioritize the bottom line rather than the public welfare, as they're programmed to do. We'll read both of the obituaries this week, starting with the reluctant rock star who drove the Rolling Stones, Charlie Watts, 1941 to 2021. Charlie Watts was the engine of the Rolling Stones. Through 58 years, 30 studio albums, and countless tours, the drummer served as the band's rock-solid timekeeper and a central ingredient in its sound. With an unhurried style that favored swing and nuance over aggression and flash, he gave Paint It Black its menacing drive, Sympathy for the Devil its hypnotic somber rhythm, and Honky Tonk Women its loose, bone-deep groove. He was the secret essence of the whole thing, said guitarist Keith Richards. Watts made for an unlikely rock star and an odd man out in a band that cultivated a Dionysian image. Quiet and dignified, he favored bespoke suits, raised horses on his English country estate, and was married to the same woman for 57 years. A lifelong jazz fanatic, he didn't seem to like rock and roll much, and he loathed stardom. I love playing with Keith in the band, I still do, but I wasn't interested in being a pop idol sitting there with girls screaming, he said in the early 2000s. I still think it's silly. Watts was born in London during the Blitz to a truck driver father and homemaker mother, said the Times. After an early affair with the banjo, he soon removed the neck and used the instrument's head as a snare drum. Watts got his first drum kit at age 14. While other teenagers were dancing to Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry, Watts was studying records by Duke Ellington and Charlie Parker. An art school-trained graphic designer, he took a job at a London ad agency and spent his evenings playing with combos in jazz clubs. Watts branched out in the early 1960s, joining Alexis Corner's Blues Incorporated, a raucous collective that sometimes included Richards and Stones lead singer Mick Jagger. Asked to join the pair's nascent band, Watts initially refused. He gave in when the rest of the Stones pooled their resources and offered him £5 a week. We went shoplifting to get Charlie Watts, wrote Richards in his memoir. The Stones' rise was swift, said the Los Angeles Times. A year after Watts played his first show with the group in 1963, their single, It's All Over Now, topped the British charts. The following year, they hit number one in the U.S. with I Can't Get No Satisfaction, propelled by the drummer's indelible swing. While the Stones indulged a collective appetite for debauchery, Watts largely abstained, said the New York Times. On tour, his habit was to retire early and sketch his hotel room. He once claimed to have drawn every bed he'd slept in since 1967. The drummer's one deviation came in the 1980s, just as the other Stones were settling into moderation. In what he later termed a midlife crisis, Watts went on a two-year bender of drugs and alcohol. He went cold turkey after falling down a staircase and breaking his ankle. In later years, Watts drew on his graphic design background to contribute to the ever more spectacular stage designs for the group's tours, said the Associated Press. He led a succession of jazz bands, including the 32-piece Charlie Watts Orchestra. Complaining of the tedium of the road, Watts vowed each Stones tour would be his last. But he unfailingly answered the call until this summer, when the band announced he'd been sidelined by an undisclosed ailment. I thought they'd last 3 months, then a year, then 3 years, he said of the Stones in 2004. Then I stopped counting. The outspoken actor who embraced activism. Ed Asner, 1929 to 2021. Ed Asner broke a personal rule when he auditioned for the Mary Tyler Moore Show in 1969. Don't do comedy. The then 40-year-old actor considered the genre a career dead end, but said he agreed to try out for the part of Lou Grant, Moore's coarse but idealistic boss at a Minneapolis TV newsroom, because he was the greatest character I ever came across. Asner would play the journalist for the sitcom's 1970 to 77 run, and for 5 seasons in the spinoff series, Lou Grant. Along the way, he won 3 Emmys for Best Supporting Actor and 2 for Best Lead, making him the only actor ever to receive comedy and drama Emmys for the same role. As uncompromising as his on-screen persona, the Fireplug Asner was a real-world political activist, loudly championing organized labor, gay rights, and other issues. When CBS canceled Lou Grant in 1982, citing declining ratings, Asner insisted he was being punished for condemning the Reagan administration's support of the junta in El Salvador. The price you pay for activism in this town, he later said, is a big one. Born in Kansas City to an immigrant junk dealer father and a homemaker mother, Asner became interested in drama as a boy, said the New York Times. He studied journalism at the University of Chicago, but dropped out in his second year to work odd jobs. Taxi driver, encyclopedia salesman, metal finisher, while he built his acting career. After serving 2 years in the Army in the early 1950s, he did stage work in Chicago and New York City before moving to Hollywood in 1961 to make a more stable living as a TV actor in California, said the Washington Post. Asner appeared in popular shows such as Gunsmoke, The Fugitive, and Police Story, and had big-screen bit parts opposite John Wayne and Elvis Presley. He secured his place in the annals of TV comedy with his first scene in Mary Tyler Moore. Following a successful interview, Asner's Lou Grant tells Moore's inexperienced job seeker, "You've got spunk." As she blushes and starts golly gee response, he barks his punchline, "I hate spunk." When the sitcom ended in 1977, Asner returned to the same character in a hard-hitting hour-long series, said Variety. Lou Grant followed the newsman in his new gig as city editor of a Los Angeles newspaper and addressed issues including nuclear warfare, domestic violence, and homelessness. The show won critical acclaim, but in the early 80s, Asner outraged conservatives by helping to co-found a group that sent medical aid to leftist rebels in El Salvador. Sponsors Kimberly Clark, Vidal Sassoon, and Cadbury pulled their ad, said Bloomberg.com, and Lou Grant was canceled 2 weeks later. Asner remained outspoken about controversial topics at USA Today. He called for the freeing of Mumia Abu-Jamal, convicted in 1982 of killing a Philadelphia police officer, and embraced conspiracy theories around the 9/11 attacks. Asner also worked to help Holocaust survivors and immigrants and remained an in-demand actor, most memorably playing Santa in 2003's Elf and voicing the elderly hero of the 2009 Pixar hit Up. "There were times when I felt terribly alone," he said of his activism and acting, "but I was also giving a feeling of nobility about my life." How do you buy that? And we've just time for a few of the short notes. The U.S. missile that killed 2 ISIS-K militants in retaliation for last week's suicide bombing uses blades instead of explosives to reduce collateral civilian casualties. The R-9X missile, dubbed the Flying Ginsu, ejects a halo of six large blades that shred individual small groups of human targets. An unvaccinated elementary school teacher in Marin County, California, infected half the students in her class of 24 after she briefly took her mask off to read a story. Most of the students infected were in the two rows closest to her desk, according to a CDC case study, and many of them spread the virus to their family members. South Dakota has seen a 456% increase in COVID cases in the 3 weeks since the Sturgis motorcycle rally drew hundreds of thousands of people to the small city of Sturgis. The state reported 3,655 active cases on August 25th, and its test positivity rate shot up from 10% to nearly 39%. And we'll finish out the show today with two quotes. We'll start with one from novelist Deborah Levy, quoted in the Los Angeles Times, who says, "Of all the arts, the art of living is probably the most important." And here's one from Tom Stoppard, quoted in Forbes.com, that's appropriate to this section. It says, "It's better to be quotable than to be honest." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.